From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a private eye in the Louisiana Bayou. We talk with James Lee Burke about his series of crime novels set in and around New Orleans. In his new book, Detective Dave Robichaux investigates a TV evangelist and an ex-Klansman turned politician. Also, a much-loved band that is famous for never quite becoming famous. We meet Terry Adams, co-founder of NRBQ. The band has been performing its eccentric brand of rhythm and blues since 1968. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Motor City. She says the most mesmerizing real-life character in this new novel is the 1954 Buick Century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Florida Governor Lawton Chiles said today that some of the areas wrecked by Hurricane Andrew looked as if they'd been hit by a bomb. Local television in Miami quoted police and emergency sources as saying there were 8 confirmed deaths, as well as 7 people presumed dead in places that rescue workers have been unable to reach. President Bush declared a federal disaster in 3 South Florida counties, making them eligible for federal emergency and long-term recovery aid. The Red Cross has opened 229 shelters to house some 84,000 people in more than 24 Florida counties. People in New Orleans are preparing for Hurricane Andrew. Deborah Frazier reports that officials have already called for some evacuations in case the storm hits Louisiana.
Floodwaters are nothing new to the New Orleans area, but the prospect of 140-mile-an-hour winds has residents scrambling to stock up on radio and flashlight batteries, canned goods, bottled water, and plywood and tape to protect their homes and businesses. The lines at grocery stores have been building all day, and the wait at gas stations is equally long as residents make sure they have a full tank in case they have to head for higher ground quickly. Workers from offshore rigs were evacuated Sunday. New Orleans city officials today have called for thousands of residents and tourists to evacuate from the lowest-lying coastal areas where the roads out may be flooded by morning, and they're recommending that other residents be prepared to move further inland. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in New Orleans.
Campaigning in New Jersey today, President Bush proposed spending billions of federal dollars on job training. Steve Inskeep reports.
Backing off his attack mode of recent days, the president told students at a technical school he wants to help inner-city youths, laid-off defense workers, and others with $10 billion for job training. The programs include Cold War retraining and so-called skill grants to help students pay for technical school.
I believe we can pay for this new job training offensive without raising taxes on people or increasing overall government spending.
Some in the president's audience of aspiring auto mechanics were thrilled with his plan.
I think it's right on target. I think that's just what we need.
Others aren't so sure.
Well, he said that the other 4 years ago, you know. I think it's a bunch of bull.
Just last week, the president proposed cutting taxes and spending, and it's not clear how he would pay for the new spending he's promising today. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New Jersey.
Stock prices declined again today on Wall Street. Analysts said investors are worried about the decline of the dollar in foreign exchange, where it reached a post-World War II low against the German mark. Stock traders fear that the declining dollar will deter the Federal Reserve from any further cuts in interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 26 points to finish the day at 3,228. This is NPR. Major wildfires are sweeping parts of California and Idaho. Hundreds of people have been evacuated from the path of Northern California's Fountain Fire, which has spread to 64,000 acres and jumped fire lines in at least 2 places. The 5-day-old fire has already destroyed more than 300 homes. In Idaho, firefighters are trying to contain a 257,000-acre fire about 30 miles east of Boise. Officials say the spread of the Foothills fire was slowed by cooler temperatures, higher humidity, and rain. About 100 federal agents, state police, and sheriff's deputies are surrounding a remote cabin in Idaho where a U.S. Marshal was killed on Friday. The man inside is believed to be a white supremacist who's wanted on federal weapons charges. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
A spokesman for the U.S. Marshal Service says agents used an armored personnel carrier to deliver a telephone to 44-year-old Randy Weaver, who's been barricaded in his Naples, Idaho cabin for more than a year. Agents hope Weaver will use the phone to communicate with them. They don't want to storm the cabin because Weaver's wife and four children may be inside. Weaver claims he was set up a year and a half ago when he was charged with selling illegal weapons to an undercover agent. New arrest warrants were issued over the weekend for Weaver and a companion in the shooting death of a U.S. Marshal Friday. Federal officials say Weaver is an avowed racist linked to the Aryan Nations Church in Idaho. A group of supporters, some wearing swastikas, protested the siege yesterday at a roadblock near the cabin. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
A federal judge in New Jersey has refused to delay the trial of the former Exxon security officer who's accused of the kidnapping and murder of Exxon executive Sidney Riso. A lawyer for the defendant, Arthur Seal, wants the September 10th trial postponed, claiming that it will be prejudiced by an upcoming TV show. CBS show 48 Hours plans to air a segment on kidnapping in mid-September. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Cajun detective Dave Robichaud is the creation of my guest James Lee Burke. His novels are set in New Orleans and the surrounding bayou. Joyce Carol Oates reviewed Burke's new book for The Washington Post. She included him among the gifted contemporary writers responsible for revitalizing the detective genre by bringing in issues of politics, gender, race, and morality. Oates writes, "Among even his talented contemporaries, Burke is something special." Burke got a late start in the field of crime fiction. His first novel was published in 1965, but he went through long periods when no one was interested in bringing out his books. One book was in play for 9 years and was rejected by 100 publishers. It wasn't until the mid-80s that Burke started writing detective novels. In his new novel, A Stained White Radiance, Dave Robichaud is investigating a Klansman-turned-politician and a TV evangelist. Here's a reading.
If you grew up in the Deep South, you're probably fond, as I am, of recalling the summertime barbecues and fish fries, the smoke drifting in the oak trees, the high school dances under a pavilion that was strung with Japanese lanterns, the innocent lust we discovered in convertibles by shadowed lakes groaning with bullfrogs, and the sense that the season was eternal, that the world was a quiet and gentle place, that life was a party to be enjoyed with the same pleasure and certainty as the evening breeze that always carried with it the smell of lilac and magnolia and watermelons in a distant field. But there is another memory, too, the boys who went nigger knocking in the little black community of Sunset, who shot people of color with BB guns and marbles fired from slingshots, who threw M-80s onto the galleries of their pitiful homes. Usually these boys had burr haircuts, jug ears, half moons of dirt under their fingernails. They lived in an area of town with unpaved streets, garbage in the backyards, ditches full of mosquitoes and water moccasins from the coulee. Each morning they got up with their loss, their knowledge of who they were, and went to war with the rest of the world. When we meet the adult bigot, the Klansman, the anti-Semite, we assume that he was bred in that same wretched place. Sometimes that's a correct conclusion. Oftentimes it's not.
Do you know anybody who you grew up with who you feel became, as an adult, one of the kinds of fascists that you're writing about?
Oh, I knew many people who grew up to be like the boys that I describe here in this piece, but these kinds of people are victims themselves. These are fellas, or sometimes women too, who are inept and not quite functional and see themselves as being disenfranchised, and they never know who they are unless they feel superior to some other group, and they're by and large innocuous and bumbling guys with banana peels for fingers. It's hard to look upon them as villains. They're almost like buffoons rather than villainous people. The kind of individual who bothers me most is the one who's calculating, who knows better, and who is of insidious intent. The person who perhaps has sociopathic tendencies, who insinuates himself into the mainstream of society. And he has one message always. He teaches others to fear and to hate our fellow man and to blame others for our own misfortune.
Now, Dave Robichaux, your detective, is drawn to people who are psychologically deformed in some way. I mean, he considers people like that to be like his extended family. the walking wounded, as he describes them. Is that an affinity you feel yourself?
Well, let's face it, who are the most interesting people in our midst? People who get up every morning and do things in a normal way, or the deeply neurotic and brain fried, the people who begin each day with a nervous breakdown, people who were shot out of a cannon 5 minutes ago. I think they're always more intriguing. I don't know. I've always felt that it's difference that saves us from ourselves. I mean, God help us if we ever become too enamored with normalcy. It's always the person who has the outrageous and eccentric view of the world who leads us away from ourselves, always. Whether it's, we're talking about Newton or Christ or Socrates, it's always the person who does everything backwards, who says no to the status quo, that has something to say. Bernard Shaw once said, "We learn from the irrational man and woman. They reject the world as it is. They do not adapt themselves to it. They seek to change it.
I want to just quote a line from your new novelist, Stained White Radiance, and this is in a paragraph where Dave Robichaux, your detective, is talking about how his extended family is people who have a peculiar difference in their makeup. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about every time he thinks that some kind of constitutional sacrifice can be justified for the greater good, he wonders what his eccentric friends would say. And he says, then I realized that the rhetoric of the greater good, would have no effect on them, because for those who were most deeply injured as children, words of moral purpose too often masked acts of cruelty.
That's right.
Tell me how that observation came to you.
Well, anyone who spends any time, with 12-step groups or in analytical therapy or analysis is going to discover something about the nature of cruelty and how oftentimes it masks itself as love. And we all, at some time in our lives, have to deal with the nature of power and authority. And so very often people who suffer the greatest psychological injury in their lives are those who were treated erratically as children, not in a way that was consistently abusive. They were often hurt in some way, psychologically, physically, but were constantly told that this was an act of love, that it was being done for the child's own good. That person grows up with his head in a microwave, and the consequence is, as a rule, he has trouble with authority, defining it. He may spend a lifetime rebelling against it, or he may embrace it. He probably will misuse power himself. And one theme in the book deals with how an injury done a child is like a stone bruise, and it perpetuates itself in the person's adult life, where the injury is compounded, and it. This is why, you know, forgiveness and atonement and reconciliation among ourselves, to my mind at least, is so important. That person doesn't have to play the hand he's dealt with. You can put it away and say, "How about 5 new cards?"
We were talking a little earlier about how crime fiction has really become the genre that's really about moral questions. Because the detective is always faced with moral questions and has to decide when it's just to kind of fudge things on the law and when it's not, and when just kind of analyzing the character of others and who is kind of morally just and who isn't, and so on. And it's also become like the novel of sensibility because you're always seeing things through the detective's eyes. I wonder if since writing crime fiction yourself, and it's only been, I think, less than 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
That you've been writing this detective series. Yeah. Have you started thinking more about, like, morality and ethics than you ever did before?
Well, that's a very good question. I think I've always written about the same kinds of people and situations, and I have never really made much of a distinction in kinds of writing, but I think your observation is just dead on correct. The contemporary crime novel, in many ways, is a form of primitive existentialism. The narrator, as you say, is almost a direct descendant of Poe's protagonist, Edgar Allan Poe's protagonist, in that he's a kind of intellectual outsider who sees a moral dilemma and a contest between good and evil in a way that seems sometimes to have almost apocalyptical proportions, because the landscape he describes is one that is at war with itself.
So how do you see the world differently now that you have to be looking at it through the eyes of your detective, Dave Robichaux?
Well, I don't think that I do. I subscribe to the notion that ultimately all our problems have to be confronted individually. I don't believe in institutional solutions. I think that's part of our contemporary self-delusion. Anyone who's ever been a victim of violent crime knows what I'm talking about. As Dave Robichaux observes, many of these people tend to become NRA members. I'm not an NRA member.
You mentioned people who've been the victims of violent crime. Does that include you? Have you ever been a victim?
My family has.
Can I ask what happened, what kind of crime it was that affected your family?
Well, my story's not significant. Everyone who's ever been in that territory knows what I'm talking about.
I understand that you don't want to talk about the incident that happened to your family, but I had already picked out a section where violence happens to in the home of Dave Robichaux, your detective. And this is a scene in the second novel that you wrote, the second Dave Robichaux novel, Heaven's Prisoners. And this is a scene in which his wife is killed by people who are really looking for him. Mm-hmm. And I'd like for you to read that for
us. Okay, thanks. This is the second novel, as you say, in the series. The first one was The Neon Rain. And the first three books of the series, The Neon Rain, Heaven's Prisoners, and Black Cherry Blues, form a trilogy. And the second book is the descent, really, into Dante's Ninth Ring when Dave loses his wife, Annie. This book, by the way, is being made into a film. Alec Baldwin's playing the lead, and Harley Payton from Twin Peaks wrote the screenplay, the adaptation. I raced through the front door into the bedroom and hit the light switch, my heart thundering in my chest. Red shotgun shells littered the doorway area. The mahogany foot and headboards of the bed were gouged and splintered with buckshot and deer slugs. The flowered wallpaper above the bed was covered with holes like black dimes. The sheet, which still lay over her, was drenched with her blood, the torn cloth embedded in wounds that wolves might have chewed. Her curly blonde hair was turned away from me on the pillow. One immaculate white hand hung over the side of the mattress. I touched her foot. I touched her blood-flecked ankle. I put my hands around her fingers. I brushed my palm across her curly hair. I knelt like a child by the bed and kissed her eyes. I picked her hand up and put her fingers in my mouth. Then the shaking started, like sinew and bone separating inside me, and I pressed my face tightly into the pillow with my wet hair against her forehead. I don't know how long I knelt there. I don't remember getting up from my knees. I know that my skin burned as though someone had painted it with acid, that I couldn't draw enough air into my lungs, that the room's yellow light was like a flame to my eyes, that all my joints seem atrophied with age, that my hands were blocks of wood when I fumbled in the dresser drawer, found the 45 and pushed the heavy clip into the magazine. In my mind's eye, I was already running through the yard, across my neighbor's pasture, through the sloping woods of oak and pine on the far side where the dirt road passed before it reached the drawbridge over the bayou.
Was that scene really hard to write?
Yeah, it sure was. That chapter was probably one of the most powerful that I ever wrote.
Because you must have felt this great affection for the character, as Dave did. I mean, you created her, and now you had decided that she had to die.
Well, I always feel the story is written in the unconscious.
Uh-huh.
That's always my feeling. I don't know how it's going. It's written somehow before the writer gets to it, and you discover the story as it unfolds day by day. It sounds a little schizoid, I'm afraid, but I believe that's about it.
My guest is James Lee Burke. He writes the Dave Robichaud detective novels. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Lee Burke, and he writes the Dave Robichaud crime novels, which are set in New Orleans. The new one is called A Stained White Radiance. I had read that you had an alcohol problem for a few years, and I was wondering if stopping coincided at all with your crime series and with the success of your fiction.
No. I belong to a 12-step fellowship today, but put it this way, through that fellowship, I learned a new point of view about many things. And the novels that have been very successful, the whole series narrated by Dave Robichaud, have as much to do with recovery as they do with social themes. And I receive hundreds of letters from people all over the country who tell me how much they received from the books, how much it helped them, are, in their opinion, how accurate the books are in describing recovery for people.
He's a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah, Dave is, sure. Yeah.
Was it helpful for you to have that character to write through some of the frustrations you might have been feeling and some of the cravings you might have had, you know, to kind of give it to the detective?
Well, is a catharsis? No, I appreciate your observation, but I don't think art is a catharsis. That therapists sometimes suggest that people paint or write. When I was teaching creative writing, some kid would sometimes enroll in my class and tell me the school counselor had concluded that he should take creative writing rather than be lobotomized. And I would think, gee, thanks a lot for sending this guy into my class. But you simply, as a novelist, chronicle in one way or another part of your own experience, and if it's written correctly, honestly, it'll be an accurate representation of some of the psychological geography that people have to traverse.
I want to get back to your novel for a second.
Okay.
There's a group of characters who you describe in the novel as the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you to describe the kind of person that you're talking about there and how you came up with that thought.
Well, I used to be a social worker in South Los Angeles, and the pool, these are the brain fried. These are the guys who, you know, arrive on this planet like, you know, a cannonball going through a stucco wall. They leave behind whole warehouses of paper, all kinds of records, parole and probation officers, marriage counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, bail bondsmen. These guys are the people with banana peels for fingers. And we think, my heavens, what are these guys doing in our society? But they provide employment for millions of other people, for guys like me who are such, who was, you know, a guy like me who was a social worker. People who complain most about these guys would be bereft if they disappeared, if the pool went away somewhere. I mean, how about all our, you know, policemen and psychiatrists, marriage counselors? What are they going to do for a job? That's on the kind of on the light side, but.
But, you know, in a way, the way you're describing them, in a way, is not unlike the way you describe the kinds of eccentrics who
sure.
you're most interested in yeah. having as an almost extended family.
Yeah.
Are they the same people?
Sure. And I knew some great guys on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Yeah, East 5th Street, as Woody Guthrie once said, is the skiddiest of the skids. And there was this one guy, I won't use his name, but he was a master at manipulation. And he would come into the office and demand that we place him in our best hotels, you know, our welfare hotels. As soon as he checked in, he'd throw all the furniture out the window, box springs. One time he ripped the laboratory out of the wall. It'd come crashing, you know, down under the cement from four stories high. And then he would run downstairs and haul it all to the secondhand store. This guy was...
Oh, to sell it.
To sell it. This guy was so infamous that in South L.A. the cops wouldn't arrest him because... This is kind of distasteful, but if they didn't cuff him right and he could get a finger down his throat, he'd throw up in the squad car.
Oh, God.
This guy was so awful, the jailer at Lincoln Heights didn't want him in his jail. He said, I couldn't take this guy anymore. This was, I mean, that's a victory, a guy that could undo the system the way this one man could.
So it sounds like your relationship with him was more of like a novelist to a character than a social worker.
Sure, I knew hundreds of people like this guy. Just truly extraordinary human beings.
Could you communicate with him?
Oh yeah, sure.
Did you feel like you understood him? Like,
sure, and it's like any policeman will tell you that he knows many, many people like this man I describe. And that oftentimes there's a kind of symbiotic and sympathetic relationship between cops and certain kinds of people who inhabit the underworld. And they both sometimes understand the existentialistic rush that they get participating in a kind of nether society, a place that ordinary people don't put much time into. And that... You know, it's something interesting about being on the full tilt boogie all the time.
So when people could sense in you that you were not the straightest guy in the world, you know what I mean? That you were kind of eccentric yourself.
Well,
do you think,
I don't know, maybe.
But do you think that they would use that to try to take advantage of you?
No.
Or do you think that they would have more of a, feel more kind of sympathetic or affectionate toward you because of that?
Most people I knew in that world had a wink of the eye at mm-hmm. respectability, and if you could share it with them, they knew you both had a kind of a Sancho Panza view of things.
James Lee Burke, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry, on your show.
James Lee Burke's new book is called A Stained White Radiance. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. NRBQ stands for the New Rhythm and Blues Quartet, but the band doesn't stick to rhythm and blues. In 1 year, NRBQ played the Berlin Jazz Festival, the New York Folk Festival, and the Grand Ole Opry. Coming up, we'll meet Terry Adams, who co-founded this eccentric band in 1968. Also, Motor City. Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel set mostly in Detroit in 1954 about a group of executives and workers in GM's Buick division. Marilyn Monroe, B.B. King, Elvis Presley, Miles Davis, and Jack Kerouac all make appearances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. People living along the Gulf Coast are moving to higher ground after Hurricane Andrew swept across southern Florida this morning and 8 people were killed. The storm knocked out power to more than 1 million people, and officials are not sure when it will be completely restored. The hurricane is now in the Gulf of Mexico. Debbie Elliott reports on some of the preparations underway along the Gulf.
The National Hurricane Center has issued a hurricane warning from Pascagoula, Mississippi to Vermilion Bay, Louisiana. But people from the Florida Panhandle to the Texas Gulf Coast are preparing for the storm, stocking up on water, canned goods, candles, batteries, and other supplies in case they're left without utilities. Forecasters say Andrew is gathering intensity over the warm Gulf waters as it moves west at 18 miles an hour. The storm is expected to turn north later tonight and could make landfall as early as Wednesday morning. The Hurricane Center predicts the eye of Andrew will pass just west of New Orleans if it does hit the northern Gulf Coast. That's prompted officials in New Orleans to urge residents to begin evacuating now to avoid traffic problems as Andrew approaches. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Gulf Shores, Alabama.
In the worst-hit area south of Miami, the storm tore off roofs and left streets blocked by trees, utility poles, and live wires. Some 1,500 National Guard troops have been called out to parts of Miami's Coconut Grove, Homestead, and other areas after reports of looting. The American Red Cross and state officials have sent trucks south filled with emergency supplies and drinking water. Residents of Dade and Broward County have been asked to boil their drinking water. Another round of Arab-Israeli peace talks is underway again in Washington, and on a more optimistic note than the last 5 rounds. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Israel's new prime minister, Itzhak Rabin, says he wants to move the negotiations faster than his predecessor did. And with that in mind, Rabin has just announced several confidence-building measures, releasing 800 Palestinian prisoners, for example, and canceling orders to deport 11 Palestinians from the occupied territories. In addition, he has sent new proposals to this round of negotiations, reportedly offering a partial Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights in exchange for peace with Syria, and regional Palestinian elections to pick an administrative council to run day-to-day affairs in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Arab delegates said the tone of today's negotiations was better than in previous rounds, but vast differences still remain between Arabs and Israelis. The Syrians say they want a full return of the Golan Heights, and the Palestinians still want an independent state. Israel says no on both counts. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 26 points in active trading. This is NPR News. In Germany, officials had to move some 200 refugees from a shelter in eastern Germany after attacks by rightist groups. Hundreds of police fought with protesters armed with stones and firebombs before order was restored some 7 hours later. Most of the refugees are gypsies from eastern Europe. Many German residents are resentful over the flood of refugees to their country and the government help that they are getting. Federal officials in Seattle have released a 20-count indictment against a Washington state man in a drug tampering case in which 2 people died and the man's wife became seriously ill. Dan Tridle of member station KPLU reports.
31-year-old Joseph Meeling is accused of trying to kill his 29-year-old wife, who nearly died after taking a cyanide-laced Sudafed capsule early last year. 2 other Western Washington state residents died, also from taking cyanide-tainted Sudafed. U.S. Attorney Mike McKay says Meeling had financial problems.
Mr. Meeling increased the life insurance coverage of his wife from $100,000 to $700,000. He attempted to kill his wife for the life insurance proceeds and placed other tampered Sudafed capsules into area stores to distract law enforcement attention away from them.
Three other tainted Sudafed capsules were found following a nationwide recall of the product. The 18-month investigation included electronic surveillance of Meeling's home. For National Public Radio, I'm Dan Tridle in Seattle.
Police in Montreal say that a man opened fire today at Concordia University and killed at least two people before he was taken into custody. According to news reports, the gunman is a professor of engineering at the school and was apparently angry over the possibility that he might lose his job. Officials say at least three people were wounded. In 1989, 14 women were killed at another school in Montreal when a gunman opened fire in a classroom. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The band NRBQ is usually described something like this. Either you've never heard of them or you love them. There's a lot of cult bands out there, but NRBQ has outlasted most of them. It was founded in 1968, the initials standing for the New Rhythm and Blues Quartet. NRBQ's enormous repertoire ranges from originals to rock and roll classics and TV themes like Batman and Bonanza. My guest, Terry Adams, is a co-founder of the group, its pianist, and a songwriter and arranger. A lot of NRBQ fans think it's hard to capture the group's spontaneity and chemistry on record, but their new record is an attempt to do just that. Honest Dollar is a collection of live recordings from the band's private tape archives, spanning 1981 to 1991. The selections were made by Adams, who also produced the album. Before we meet him, let's listen to the opening track from a performance recorded in Hartford, Connecticut in 1988.
Ladies and gentlemen, NRBQ!
Remember last summer when we had the chance to find each other, start making romance? But it didn't come off because you found another without one hand of the clock. What good is the other? And I can't find your true love. Oh, baby, it's so hard. And I still think about you every time I'm riding in my car. Well, I went to the place where everybody hangs out to see what everybody wasn't talking about. And over in the corner all alone with you was the boy from last summer singing songs to you. Ooh, it seemed like I can sing.
Now, you're the one who calls the tunes on stage and decides, like, what to play. Do you read the audience when you're performing and try to figure out what's going to work that night?
I do. I don't feel comfortable with a prearranged idea of what we're going to play. It's never worked for us. We tried it maybe 20 years ago once, and I don't know. You really can't predict how a room is going to feel or how an audience is going to be and what's going to be needed at a particular time.
Let me get back to the new CD. Do you have a favorite from here that you'd like to play?
Well, I like Al singing on It's a Sin to Tell a Lie. It was the first time we ever did it, and I remember we were holding up the guy who sells the T-shirts was holding up the lyrics for him, and I think he did a great job on it.
We didn't know the song?
No, we'd never done it before. I think maybe half of the songs on there we had never done before.
So this is kind of perverse of you to call a tune that nobody knows.
We used to do the thing in the 70s with a magic box, we called it, where people would put songs in and we'd pull them out of there and then do them. But we don't do that anymore. It's not as much fun as it was then. But that was the idea was... It was fun for us to do just what you said, not know the chords, what key it's going to be in, or the lyrics, and see what comes out of it.
Now, you grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. What was the rock scene like when you were growing up? Was there much of one?
Well, it was 10 years behind whatever was really going on in the rest of the world, generally.
Can you remember an example of what was happening that was so far behind the rest of the world?
And it's hard to say, as late as, well, I left there in 66, but by then I'd say that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were well established in the rest of the world. But in Louisville, if you were in a band and your hair, if I let my hair grow just to touch the top of my ears, I could be thrown out of that band, you know, by booking agency or whatever. In fact, I was. I know hair isn't music, but I just give you an example of what was going on where I grew up.
So a booking agency threw you out of the band because your hair was touching your earlobes?
Yes, and we're talking about 1966. So,
what kind of band was it?
Well, they named themselves after the English sound. They were called the Merseybeats USA, but yet when it really came to living it, they weren't ready for it. But I had to make my own way in Louisville. I had to seek out music. I had to find things that weren't readily available there.
Was there a record shop you could go to?
I had to special order my stuff through the mail, or, you know, to find out about Sun Ra or the Thelonious Monk, Paul Bley, Carla Bley, all that kind of stuff. You had to seek it out. I would like to see people today seek out music like we did.
Makes it more thrilling when you get it, though, when you've worked so hard to find it. Yeah,
that's great.
So, yeah, everybody who you just mentioned is a jazz musician, you know, jazz pianist, in fact. So how come you ended up going more in a rock direction, being so influenced by jazz?
Well, I was influenced by everything. Like I say, Link Wray was my early great influence, and Thelonious Monk as a pianist. I think that I just... through growing up, remember discovering jazz, and for a brief period, maybe about a week, you know, not hiding, but putting my rock records in a different corner so that I was now officially a jazz person. You know, there was some kind of idea, and I think it's still going on today, where if you like a certain kind of music, you have to sign up for it, like it's some kind of club. Mm-hmm. With membership dues or something. But it didn't take me long to figure it out when the Beatles came out, that all music was one thing. And whatever you call it, it's all one thing.
You actually started playing trumpet, right?
Yeah, I started out as a trumpet player.
Why did you start on trumpet?
I don't know. My brother Don played trombone, and there was no piano around the house, so I hadn't even thought of piano yet.
Uh-huh. And that lasted for, what, a year before you started piano instead?
No, a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. What made you realize that the piano was really your instrument?
Basically, that you could play more than one note at a time. It thrilled me to play two notes at once, three notes at once.
Mm-hmm. What were the first licks on piano that you learned to play, say, from a record or something, when you realized, I can really do this?
I don't know. I think I started playing Sentimental Journey because... that's the song that we used to play on the doorbell.
How many notes did you have on your doorbell?
Two.
Well, there's four in the song.
Well, you can get, let's see, you can get through the first 3.5 bars in Sentimental Journey with two notes.
Uh-huh. That's true.
And they
there's four. There's four.
Where do you get four?
Da 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 da.
No.
It lowers.
No, it doesn't. Let's do it again.
Da 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 da.
It stays on the same two notes.
I'm tone deaf when I sing, but I'm sure that the note changes. But
no, it doesn't.
All right.
Ask your many fans out there to write in.
Oh yeah, well.
And then it changes. Yeah. Okay, so that's our song on the doorbell.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, you know, when you sing it, I hear you're probably right, though, in my head. In the version that plays in my head, we change notes.
the next 8 bars does.
Right, right. So
you're just skipping ahead. You're moving on.
Right.
You're an impatient person.
What kind of bands were you in, besides this band that you were fired from because of your hair?
Well, that's pretty much it. I had a jazz trio when I was 14 or so.
Uh-huh.
And we played regularly on a television show in Louisville.
A television show? What, local show?
Uh-huh, called High Varieties. Teen Talent of Kentuckiana.
Was it a talent showcase kind of show?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Those are great.
Yeah, they were great.
That's some of the best amateur television around.
I know. I got thrown off of there, too, though. So.
What'd you do?
I started, well, the music advanced, you know. We had heard Ornette Coleman, and we're starting to play Free. And
I'm sure that went over real big.
I don't know. I thought it was pretty. You know, it's funny about Ornette Coleman. The people were so frightened at the time, I remember, but it was such a simple, friendly music.
Mm-hmm.
And simple and harmless. If you hear those recordings he did for Atlantic, you can hear just what was all the fuss about. It's just very, it sounds like very nice people.
My guest is Terry Adams, co-founder of the band NRBQ. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Terry Adams is my guest of the band NRBQ. They have a new album called Honest Dollar. Now, since we've been talking about like jazz and rock and how you really love both and have been inspired by both, I thought maybe we could play your version of Monk's Little Rudy Tootie that's on a Monk anthology that Hal Wilner produced of like different jazz and rock groups playing Monk compositions. I'm going to kind of jump ahead to your solo in this. And I think it's really interesting. You're doing this really Monk-inspired solo over a really driving rock beat played by the drummer.
Right.
Is that challenging?
No. You know, Monk's music swung harder than rock and roll, really. It's just whether the...
Oh, I know, but...
Whether you're hearing the beat on the snare drum or the hi-hat really is the difference.
Uh-huh.
You know.
The beat just seems in... It's just a completely different kind of drumming than you'd ever hear on a Monk record.
Yeah, definitely a louder snare drum than any Monk player, Monk's drummer would have done. I like, to me, when I play the music of Thelonious Monk, I can't separate the composition from the style. I hear a lot of it, since he's died, a lot of people play his songs, and I think that's great. But mm-hmm. I don't know, whenever I play, I think it's a whole thing. It's not just the song, but it's the whole spirit should remain throughout all the solos, everything. You know, I think that's the way to really be true to his music.
In addition to playing piano, you also often play the clavinet. Why don't you describe what a clavinet is?
It's a stringed instrument. It's I think it's the same thing as a clavichord, which is a Baroque instrument, isn't it? I'm not sure, but a clavichord was a quiet stringed instrument in the 1600s or something. But this has pickups on it, so. It actually has strings. You have to tune it before every performance, sometimes in the middle of a performance. They don't make them anymore. They don't make the strings anymore. I'm down, I go through about 2 clavinets a year, and I think I only have 2 left. So.
Did you stockpile them when you knew they were going out of business?
I try to, but the model that I like to play is harder to find. But it's a thrill for me to play the strings. A lot of people suggest, well, why don't you just play, you know, get this sound, imitated sound, a synthetic version of it on the synthesizer. But believe me, it's not the same. It's the difference in, say, driving a real hot car as the similarities in sitting in front of one of those video screens with a steering wheel.
So what is it that you like so much about the sound of a clavinet?
It gives me a chance to be a guitar player, I think. You know?
But it's a keyboard instrument, isn't it?
I know, but it sounds like a guitar. Sometimes people don't even think that I'm playing on our records. It'll just be a clavinet piece, and they'll think it's Al playing.
What's an example of a record like that?
Well, Me and the Boys is almost all clavinet. Al comes in on the bridge in the middle, and that's about it.
Just a bunch of gas getting in the car, no matter who's driving off or how far. Feels so good, feels so loud. No taxi driver still is out of drive. Me and the Boys.
That's Me and the Boys from the NRBQ album Peekaboo. NRBQ has a new album called Honest Dollar on Rykodisc. I spoke with the band's co-founder, Terry Adams. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Lynn Near is with us. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Terry. We'll have an update on Hurricane Andrew, and we'll have a report from Miami on the damage that was caused by the hurricane as it passed over the city early this morning. Then we'll go out west to find out what's happening out there with fires. They're causing a great deal of problem there. And we'll have a report on some of the additional problems that the expense of fighting the fires is creating for the already overburdened California budget. And then we'll have a report from Daniel Zwerdling, who visits a farm in Kenya, which is encouraging its workers to have small families. It's a small private effort that could become a model program for family planning in Kenya and the rest of Africa.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're looking for a good end-of-summer read, critic Maureen Carrigan recommends Motor City, a lively first novel by Bill Morris.
Just about everybody who was anybody in the 1950s makes an appearance in Motor City. Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio, Ike and Mamie, Elvis, Miles Davis, and the king of the road himself, Jack Kerouac. But the most mesmerizing real-life character in this novel is the 1954 Buick Century. The Century was the car of the year. It came in lots of jaunty color combinations, seafoam green and canary yellow, shrimp pink and anthracite black, and it sported a wraparound windshield, Dynaflow transmission, white walls, and a steering wheel as big as a basketball hoop. One of its admirers in Motor City describes the appeal of the Century this way. It was a stunning departure from the stodginess of cars in the 40s and early 50s, a car that announced that the war was now ancient history, so let the good times roll. For Bill Morris, the Buick Century is both a metaphor for the vulgar exuberance of the mid-50s and a literal vehicle for transporting readers back into the past. The Century is to Morris what the tea biscuit was to Proust. One whiff of that simonized new car smell, and we're off for a long, seductive test drive down memory lane. Motor City, as its title suggests, is mostly set in Detroit in 1954. It tells the story of a group of executives and workers in GM's Buick division who are furiously trying to beat out Plymouth for third place in annual sales. There's an ex-reporter turned publicity hack named Will Lomax, his boss, Ted Mackey, a chrome-plated creep, and an ambitious young car designer named Claire Hathaway, who's having an affair with Ted. These and other fictional characters keep colliding with actual 50s personalities. In fact, the great fun of Motor City is that its plot lines are as intricate as highway interchanges, looping around, crisscrossing, and running parallel to history. When Will is flying back from a business trip to California, who should be sitting next to him on the plane but Ray Kroc, the visionary salesman who's just bought a hamburger joint from a couple of brothers named McDonald. Claire, we learn, lost her virginity in college to her literature professor, an eccentric Russian emigre named Nabokov. And Ted Mackey has the phone conversation of his dreams with Marilyn Monroe when he tries to persuade her to star in an ad campaign as GM's Wildcat Girl. But Morris isn't just interested in presenting a Happy Days version of the 1950s. His extended cast of characters also bumps into Joe McCarthy and Father Coughlin. And there's a sad subplot in which a GM exec searches for his lost Japanese sweetheart, only to discover that her face was destroyed in the bombing of Hiroshima. The great danger of a fictional factoid novel like Motor City is that it can become too gimmicky, like one of those so-called historical episodes of Quantum Leap. Morris does make one jackknife plot turn to ensure that a character meets the undiscovered Elvis, but otherwise, he never strays over the white line that separates the barely credible from the out-and-out contrived. Sure, I knew Morris was taking me for a ride in Motor City, and I enjoyed every single gas-guzzling minute of it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Stephen Waterman. Roberta Shurock directs the show. And for helping us through a power outage, special thanks to Bob Alls, Jay Goldman, Bill Weber, Michael Cullen, Gary Henderson, and Karen Perlman. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the rhetoric of the presidential campaign with campaign analyst Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She's the author of the new book, Dirty Politics: Deception, Distraction, and Democracy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.